Well, hello everyone. All this week I've been looking at theorists of mass society, mass propaganda, brainwashing, brain control, the psychology of crowds, and so on and so forth. I started with Gustave Le Bon, then we looked at Walter Lippmann, yesterday we looked at Edward Bernays. Today we're going to be looking at probably the ultimate of these theorists, Louis Althusser. Now, he does not feature in the populist delusion, but he does feature quite heavily in applied elite theory, where there I have two essays, or one big essay now, called Defining Ideology, which draws quite heavily from Althusser. I also wrote on Althusser in my earlier career in these two books here, Shakespeare's History Plays, where there's a dedicated chapter critiquing Althusser, and there's also a chapter on Althusser in Shakespeare and Contemporary Theory, because he ended up being very influential in cultural studies, in literary studies, as well as in Western Marxism more generally. But where we're interested in him here is in his theory of ideology. His most famous essay is called Ideology and the Ideological State Apparatuses, which is quite a mouthful, but that's what it's called. So his basic idea is that society in itself is a structured whole. Okay, he argued that society is composed of relatively autonomous levels, the economic, the political, the ideological, each with its own logic, its own kind of governing logic. Yet ultimately, in the last instance, society is governed by the economic layer, okay? Now, this was basically Althusser in a nutshell. We don't need to get bogged down in Marxist theory, but it was Althusser dealing with the materialist underpinnings of Marxism when he wanted to write about ideology, something that, you know, so it appears, you know, is not a material thing. It's ideas in people's heads. It's their beliefs and so on. Yet Marxism is meant to have this materialist base. So Althusser is saying, like, look, in the last instance, it's the economic base that determines what goes on in a society. But for a lot of the time, it's ideology doing a lot of the heavy lifting, the ideological superstructure, what actually motivates people to think, to act, to do things. This ultimately a lot of the time is doing a lot of the heavy lifting, doing a lot of heavy work. You know, he has this phrase, individuals work by themselves in ideology, okay? For people to get up, brush their teeth, go to work, believe that they need to go to work, they need ideology, okay? Ultimately, it's the economic base that is ultimately determining why all the rest of this exists, why that ideology exists in the way it does. Okay. But in terms of the everyday working of things, it's the ideology that's making it all happen. The state has two mechanisms of control, which he calls the RSA and the ISA, that is the repressive state apparatuses. That's your army, it's the police, it's courts, the judicial system, prisons, okay? Anything that threatens physical violence to keep people in order is an RSA, the repressive state apparatuses. You would also include the intelligence services, MI5 and MI6, or the CIA and the FBI in America. They are all part of the RSA, or the RSAs. Then there are the ISAs, that is the ideological state apparatuses, and that is what today a lot of people would call the soft power, right? The soft mechanisms of persuasion, schools, media, churches, trade unions, things like that, but also pivotally the family, right? The family is the number one replicator of the state ideology. It is the number one replicator of things kind of working themselves out. Families, mothers and fathers, teach their kids how to be good, productive citizens in capitalist society. but not just in capitalist society, in any society, in order for that society to work, parents need to teach their kids how to be in that society. So in a good communist society, they would need to interpolate, Althusser's word, those children into communist ideology. Or if it was the feudal society, they would, you know, the you would be, you know, a peasant would be born to a peasant father. And, you know, even before he is born, he already has all the accoutrements of his, you know, allocated social role. And it's quite easy to see when we look back on medieval feudal society, how this process works. Okay, you have been born a peasant, you shall be a peasant, you shall work in the field, etc. Because it was fairly static. But this exact same process goes on in our modern society, okay? But it's rather than you are a little bourgeois, you shall grow up to be a bourgeois, you shall have bourgeois hopes and dreams, you shall go on to be a good bourgeois citizen. The ISAs and the reproduction of relations. Ideological state apparatuses are the primary mechanism through which the ruling class reproduces the relations of production across generations. By shaping consciousnesses and social practice, ISAs ensure that the existing order is experienced as natural and inevitable. This is natural and normal. This is the normal state of things. It is normal to get up and go to work and work in an office from 9 to 5. This is natural and normal. It is normal to get up and wear a school uniform and brush your teeth and go to school and learn about all the things that you learn about in school and come home again. This is natural and normal. It is natural and inevitable. And this is experienced simply as how things are. So, or if you want to put it another way, this is common sense. It's common sense. Of course, that's how things are meant to work. Of course, you're meant to get up, brush your teeth and go to school. Of course, that's natural and normal. Of course, you get up and go to work. What else would you be doing? But it's not just these things like going to work or going to school. It is more or less everything that you think, feel, and choose in that society. Now, when I used to give my lecture on Althusser, and I gave this lecture dozens upon dozens of times to wide-eyed first-year students, they'd come in. And I remember giving that lecture, and they'd often be sitting there open-mouthed as I dismantled their entire childhood. I'd said, listen, even your hopes and dreams, your hopes and your dreams have been inculcated in you by the ideological state apparatuses. And it's not just the obvious sinister ones. It's everything. It's Frozen and Frozen 2. And your favorite pop star, and all of the messaging that they've given you from the minute that you're born, all of your hopes and dreams. And you think that you are freely choosing those hopes and dreams. You think that you are freely choosing to wear this makeup today, or to wear this jacket today, or to, you know, that you're expressing your own individual nature. Okay, I'm an individual because I like Pink Floyd, whereas you're an individual because you like you too. But actually, each one of those thoughts was implanted in you, and each one of those thoughts is replicating the core ideology of the capitalist state, according to Louis Althusser. And if you then start to pick up these texts, Frozen, Frozen 2, you name it, any film that you can think of, Harry Potter, and then you start to unpick the ideological underpinnings of each of these things, you will find the core ideology of our current system is embedded in them. Whether or not the people who made those things were even aware of it. Because a lot of what ideology does functions on the level of the unconscious. It functions on a level that people aren't even aware of. They don't even know that they're doing it. In applied elite theory, I talk about, imagine a group of goldfish in a goldfish bowl. They're not actually aware that they're in a goldfish bowl. You can see them because you're outside of it. But most people who are in ideology cannot actually see the fact that they're in there in the first place until somebody points it out to them and they're jolted out of their passivity. Okay, and you can see how this feeds into the Marxist notion of class consciousness. But the key point for Althusser is that it is not simply the proletariat or the working class who are inculcated into ideology. It is everybody. It is all the bourgeois, all the managers, all the upper classes, the prime minister, whoever, everybody, your teacher, your university lecturers. They're all in ideology and they don't even realize it half the time. And what was always striking to me was that even the people who were teaching this stuff could not see that they were in ideology. They could not see that when they, for example, wore the rainbow flag or the pride lanyard, that they were reproducing the official state ideology as they were doing it. They could not see, or many of them could not see, that they had become the very replicators of the official state ISA that they were talking about in their own material. One of the great ironies of Western education is that they teach this stuff, but they cannot see it. If they cannot see it, or they're stuck forever deconstructing the 1950s. Whereas in fact, it's always all around us, always already embedded with official doctrine. Ideology is the imaginary relation between a person's real conditions, that is his real material conditions, and his imaginary relations to them. And in fact, it's more than that. It is material, according to Althusser, because it is the representation of this imagined relationship between real conditions and the imagined relations made manifest, made material. So what would this be in real terms? Well, I mean, again, it's easier. It's always easier when we point to, a bygone time where it's so much more crude and so much more obvious. So, for example, let us imagine there was a king and they had built a statue to this king holding aloft his sword with his crown. Now, that statue is the material representation of the imagined relationship between that individual, in this case, the king, okay, and the real conditions around him. The crown was a representation of that. His sword was, and the very fact that this statue exists. But it's not simply the statue, it's everything. So, for example, if it is a university, it would be the very buildings of the university itself is a representation of the imagined relationship between the individuals who are there and their real conditions. In the cold light of day, the university is just a collection of buildings, bricks with books in it, and classrooms and things like that. But everybody who's there imagines that they're in a place of learning. And it's not just the imagined relationship between those people and the buildings, there's also the relations between the individuals themselves. So the lecturer who stands up there, or the professor who stands up there, well, he has an imagined relation between himself or herself and the class in front of them. For Althusser, ideology represents the imagined relationship of individuals to their real conditions of existence. It is a set of social meanings that shapes how people understand their world. Ideology is a lived, practical relation. It feels real and necessary to those who are inside it. It helps individuals make sense of their place in the world while also distorting the underlying power relations that structure that world. And as I just talked about, ideology also has a material existence. It is the practice. I mean, it's even more than the, you know, the statue or the building. It is rituals, practices, thing, you know, all sorts of customs that exist, that play out over and over and over again to give this ideology a living, breathing, material existence. Obviously, I mean, this is more obvious in some areas like religions and churches and things like that than others. But think about how ritualistic school is. You know, you go to assembly, the bell rings, all of these little codifiers, people used to clock in and clock out of work, that all sorts of little everyday customs and rituals people have, if you work in an office, you know, gathering around the water cooler, all of these little things have an ideological existence for Althusser. And where Althusserian analysis starts is in actually starting to break down, deconstruct, and think about how all these things work. What is actually happening here in each of these things, and what power relations are being covered up by their existence? I mean, one of the things that you might say is that, you know, I talked about the water cooler. It became vogue for a long time for big, you know, firms, big tech firms, Google, for example. I've known people who've worked at Google, and they've got the, you know, chefs on site and meditation rooms and rooms where you can go and play PlayStation if you want. And it's kind of like, you know, there was this whole dream for a while of working for a big company. Working for this big, you know, you're part of this big machine, but you're made to feel special. You're a kind of a really valued member of the team here, and you have time to think, and we're going to treat you like a real person. Althusser would say, yeah, but what's actually happening here? This relationship between the company and the employee is still exploitative in some way. You're covering up all sorts of power relations. You're just feeding into various delusions that employee has, thinking that they're special or whatever. But really what's happening is this. And really what's happening is that all of these people here in this company are involved in perpetuating a particular system. A system that exists ultimately to drive profit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of Althusser's famous ideas, and I've already mentioned the word, is interpolation. Okay, he talks about being hailed as a subject. Now, this graphic here shows a policeman calling a person over. Okay, now you imagine you're in a street and there's the policeman there, and the policeman says, hey, you there, come over here. You, come over here. You're being hailed. Now, when that happens, you are being interpolated, quote unquote, as a subject by the ideological state. You recognize the man as a policeman, as a figure of authority. You recognize yourself as a mere subject of the state. You must respond. You must say, yes, yes, I have acknowledged that you have hailed me. I come over, and therefore you become the subject. Okay? But, and this is where the interpolation process goes even further, it is not simply in this moment when the policeman hails you over that you are interpolated. You are interpolated every time somebody calls you by your name, every time somebody says good morning, hello, how are you, every time somebody says anything to you, acknowledges you at all, you are being drawn in to the kind of ideological lang. You can imagine it as the whole interwoven system above, you're the little instances of ideological subject below. Every time that happens and you say, okay, so, hey, you there, are you Nima? Are you Nima Parvini? Yes, that's me. That's my given name. I identify as this person. I have this history. I've done these things. I acknowledge all of this is me. I live in Britain. I have this amount of money. All of these sorts of things, you in that moment where you're hailed, you accept them all. And you say, amen, so be it. This is it. I accept this reality, this constructed reality around me that I have been told my whole life I accept as being real and true. Individuals who recognize themselves in the call of ideology willingly accept their assigned role, reproducing the system from within without overt coercion. And again, lots of people might be thinking, ha ha, well, yeah, you know, I would be the rebel. I wouldn't be interpolated. I would, you know, I'm my own man. I'm an individual. I'm a free thinker. I'm John Wayne. You know, a lot of people think like this, but actually, when push comes to shove, 99.9% of all people in all times and all places, when they're hailed, respond and are interpolated. It's so difficult not to have this happen. It's almost impossible, as Althusser lays it out, to even function in a society without willingly accepting your assigned role within it. Ideology, of course, is an unconscious brainwashing process. The ideological domination operates largely unconsciously through language, everyday rituals, social practice, as we've talked about. Subjects come to experience their own subjection as natural, as freely chosen, as even pleasurable. This renders ideological power far more durable and effective than direct repression. Okay, that phrase of Althusser's, in the last instance. Well, in the last instance, yes, there's a man with a gun. In the last instance, if you don't do as you're told, a policeman with a truncheon will come and beat you over the head. If you don't play by the rules of society, you will get put in jail. Or in some societies, they'll even kill you. But most of the time, it doesn't need to come to that. Most of the time, you do it all by yourself. You are that good citizen. You do what you're told. You do exactly what is expected of you, 9 times, 10 times out of 10. Woe betide the person who steps out of line. Then you shall activate the Agent Smith. And again, you don't need the policeman or the official arm of the state there. Most of the time, other people will do it for you. This is the famous snitch in George Orwell, of course, or in, you know, you think of the snitch in Soviet Russia or Nazi Germany or something like this. But in quiet ways, people will bring you back into line. People will stop you going off the reservation. They will bring you back to the official doctrine. And again, if you don't believe me, try it out. Next time you're with normal people, somebody who hasn't watched this video, try it out. Try to go off the reservation a little bit and see how quickly you will activate Agent Smith. One of capitalism's great tricks, according to Althusser, is its ability to not only do this to people, but to make them think they're doing it naturally and freely and that they want this, that they want this. I want to watch this Netflix series. I really enjoy it. Now, from a pure Althusserian perspective, you are pumping your mind full of propaganda and ideology, willingly. I want to consume this pornography. My favorite thing in the world is to watch porn. Again, from a pure Althusserian perspective, you are just pouring poison straight down your ears and into your eyes. I freely and willingly subscribe to and buy this newspaper. Think about it. Think about what people do. People willingly buy newspapers. I mean, from a certain point of view, it is absurd. I am willingly buying the right to be propagandized by these journalists and this whoever owns this newspaper. And what's incredible about the human mind is that you can see it when it's other people. there are thousands upon thousands of smug Guardian readers who mock the people who buy the Sun or who read Rupert Murdoch newspapers or the Daily Telegraph or, oh my God, the Daily Mail. They're willingly spending their money, you ridiculous people, not realizing that they do exactly the same things themselves every time they buy the Guardian or the, you know, New Statesman or whatever it is they buy. So they can, the point is, it's the awareness. People can never see themselves in ideology. Think about your Fox News channel, right? Fox News regularly talks about the quote unquote mainstream media. It's literally Fox News. But the smug boomer who watches Fox News doesn't acknowledge that they are trapped in an ideological bubble. They can't see it. They can't see outside of it, whether it's your Guardian reader or your Fox News watcher. Before I continue, friends, I have to give you a bit of my own ideology, my own ISA, if you want. I have to keep the lights on here. But also, it is summer, and that means it's the summer sale. Pick up a course at the ideological agency, the academic agency. It's for promo code Scorcher. I'll play the ad, and when we come back, I'll talk more Altazair. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Scorcher. Get it now. Scorcher. 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 Promo code Scorcher. 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 Buy it now. All right. Ideology makes domination appear as if it is freedom. Okay, now I've talked about this already, but it's capitalism's number one trick. Ideology simply tells people what to think and structures the very framework through which they think, feel, and act. By interpolating individuals as free subjects, the system renders exploitation invisible to those inside it. Now, the difference between Althusser and Edward Bernays, who I talked about yesterday, is that Edward Bernays was talking about all of this as an inside man and as somebody who supported the bourgeois liberal democratic regime that he lived in. He was an aider and abettor, and he was actually, all of his work was teaching the invisible dictators, if you want to put it that way, to do their work better. Okay, how can we do this even better? And this is natural and normal, according to Bernays. Althusser, as a Marxist, as an outsider, as someone who wanted to bring down the capitalist order, saw it from the outside. But in effect, they are describing exactly the same thing. They are describing the same process. You start with a structure perception. Ideology frames how we see things. People are allotted their chosen roles. Individuals adopt roles as if they are freely chosen. And then these roles are normalized and exploited. Exploitation appears natural and rational. Now, what are we really talking about here? What are we really talking about? We're talking about when people identify so fully with their ideologically assigned role that it becomes who they are. Think about how many people define themselves through their job. Through their job. Yes, I am a fireman. My name is John and I am a fireman. This is who I am. Amen. I'm Dave and I'm a miner. I'm proud of being a miner. I am a miner. Yes. Whole communities were built on these sorts of identities. And what Althusser was saying was, look, fireman or miner or whoever else, you're being exploited. You're being taken for. You might think that you're proud of doing this, but think about the systems of economic relations that keep this whole structure in place. In other words, these are the narratives we weave ourselves to cope with the choices that we make in our lives. But those choices, in a sense, were pre-written. They were kind of always going to be there. Again, what do I mean by this? What do I mean by this? Well, I could say, well, hold on a second. It was me. I chose to do English in school, and I chose to study English at university, and then I chose to go on to be an academic and a professor and a writer of books. I chose this. Althusser would say, well, did you? Looking at your socioeconomic background, looking at the sort of people your parents were, right? You were always going to do something like this. Looking at the country that you were born into, you were always going to do, if it wasn't, you know, doing English, maybe you'd have chosen a different subject, but you would have done something like this. And this is, let's face it, a bourgeois path through life. You were a bourgeois. You were born a bourgeois. You were always going to be a bourgeois. And of course, you lived the life of a bourgeois. And look at you with your Alice in Wonderland mug and your stupid instant coffee, he'd say. And the fact is, he's basically right. He's basically right about that. It's a very difficult realization to come to. But if you zoom out enough, it is true that many of your so-called life choices were kind of already made. All right, you might choose. I mean, it's like the difference between. It's the difference between, okay? The thing is, I like the Mars bar. I don't like the dairy milk. All right, I've got the Cadbury's dairy milk or the Mars bar. Okay, well, I chose to do English and write books and become a professor. But the difference between, let's say I could have gone on to be a lawyer or something like that, or gone into finance, something like this, okay? Okay, well, it makes a marginal difference with how much money you make and blah, 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 blah. But the fact is, these are the sorts of things that somebody of my background was going to do. Okay, somebody born in the 80s in this Britain, in Margaret Thatcher's Britain, I was going to do something like that. Is there a real difference between going to the shop and buying the Mars bar or the Cadbury's chocolate bar? Althusser would say, well, look, all you're doing, look, okay, it's a choice between this capitalist company and this capitalist company. You're £1.30 instead of going to Cadbury's, now it goes to Mars. But the fact is, what's happened, the actual economic relationship there is basically the same. Your choice was not really a choice. You weren't making any meaningful choice. So zoomed out in this way, my choice to go on to be an English professor, say, was no different from choosing a Mars bar or a Galaxy or a Cadbury's bar. Didn't really make a difference to anything at all. I was still more or less being that good bourgeois citizen and helping to replicate the ideological state apparatus, helping to replicate the entire structure of this society that I've been born into. Self-policing and the power of internalization. Now, I've already touched on this, really. This is the Agent Smith idea. You know, yes, you get overt repression. Yes, you get the truncheon on the head. Yes, you get sometimes the policeman knocking at the door. Okay. But most of the time, people work by themselves. They keep each other in line. They self-police. And in the ultimate case, people don't even need anybody else. It's not that somebody gonna go okay. If that happens, it's almost sometimes already too late. Most of the time, most people in most times and places police their own speech, police their own thoughts even. They don't allow themselves to think certain things. Again, George Orwell wrote eloquently about this, but he was talking about totalitarian societies. Althusser is talking about our society. He's talking about this society. In fact, George Orwell was also talking about this society, but that's another video, one that exists back in the long history of the channel. Search George Orwell, you'll find that video. you won't regret it. But you understand what I'm saying, right? People do it themselves. They don't need anybody over their shoulder to tell them what to do, because they've already been brainwashed. They've already been interpolated by society, by ideology. This makes ideology one of the most insidious mechanisms of class rule in modern societies. And the final idea from Althusser, and this is in his book, Four Marx. I've ranged a little bit outside of the one essay here. Because a lot of people were like, look, Louis, you know, monsieur, this is all well and good, but it's quite demoralizing, Monsieur Althusser, because you're meant to be a Marxist, and this is not really inspiring the chances of our revolution here, mate. It doesn't seem like the revolution. It seems like the capitalist state is all powerful. It seems like nothing's going to, you know, keep on self-perpetuating all the time. What can we do to overthrow this? How does revolution even happen? How did the Russian Revolution happen? How did any revolution happen? How did the Iranian Revolution happen in 79? Or the French Revolution, Louis? And this is where he comes up with the concept of overdetermination. The actual word is borrowed from Sigmund Freud and a psychoanalyst called Jacques Lacan, who talked about this thing called the mirror phase. But we don't need to get into where overdetermination comes from. What we really need to understand is that as societies, as a kind of power structure develops, the ideology will start generating social, what Althusser calls contradictions. And these contradictions start becoming more and more complex and more numerous. They multiply as time goes on. And eventually, there's such a gap between the official ideology itself and the messages that people are given and the actual lived reality, and so many contradictions exist that people simply no longer can believe in the messages that they're given. And you then get what he calls an overdetermination, a confluence of factors moving the other way, i.e. against the people who are in power. So when revolutions take place, there are enough disgruntled parts of society that no longer believe in the official messaging for one reason or another, that then you get the revolution that takes place. However, this is very rare, and there are many, many false dawns. There are many, many times where it looks like it's happening, but it's actually not. And Althusser's entire body of work on ideology in particular can be seen as a way of answering the question that every Marxist must ask, which is, why didn't the revolution happen? Marx and Engels predicted a communist revolution. Didn't predict it in Russia. He predicted it in London and in Paris and in New York. It's 2026 now. There's still not been a communist revolution in London, in Paris, or New York. Many right-wingers watching this will be snickering to themselves and saying, what about Sadiq Khan? What about Mamdani? And so on. To which the authentic Marxist would say, you must be having a laugh. Sadiq Khan is a liberal capitalist. Mamdani is not a genuine revolutionary. He wouldn't even be running to be the mayor of New York if he was a committed revolutionary. The ultimate question, though, why didn't the revolution happen? Well, everything I've just been talking about is the answer. Capitalism is extremely adept at reproducing itself through all of these mechanisms that I've talked about. And it's also very good at repackaging and recommodifying rebellion as product. another sneaky thing that capitalism does. I'll never forget. I was driving into the university one day. This was about 10 years ago. And I saw a group of students on the university logo, on the thing that they had there. And they were they had the one of those long selfie sticks, right? Selfie sticks there. And they were taking a big photo of themselves on the mascot of this university doing the revolutionary fist. And looking at that, Althusser would say, is anything actually revolutionary happening here? Or is this merely the pastiche of something they think they should be doing? Is this the role-playing of rebellion? They are wearing the aesthetics of revolution when in fact they're doing one of the most conservative things imaginable, reproducing the ideological state apparatus in themselves in the very place that is, i.e. a modern-day university, a basic factory of capitalist workforce, which is what they are, what those students were and are. What did they end up doing, Althusser would say? Did they end up leading a communist revolution? No. They went on to work for Microsoft and Google and Unilever and this multinational and this large humanitarian organization. I.e. they became the very perpetuators of the system itself. Now, why am I going on this extended tangent? Because in 1968, there was a large student rebellion in France in May of 1968. And this then was copied all across the West in 1968. This was the great moment of boomer rebellion. And people thought, maybe now, this is the time that the revolution is coming. People are awake. This was the counterculture coming to roost. And Althusser, who was alive and working in Paris at that time as a professor, said, all of you are being juvenile. These rebellions will amount to nothing. This is mere cosplaying what you people are doing. This is nothing. All of you are going to end up being good little capitalist replicators yourselves, good little citizens. Okay, this is adolescent juvenilia playing out. And when he said that, many Marxists and leftists at the time felt let down by Althusser, who had been their mentor. They felt let down that he was not giving them hope or leadership or inspiration in this moment, but actually kind of, you know, pissing on their bonfire a little bit. But now fast forward to 2026, and who was right and who was wrong? Was there any sort of revolution realistically in Britain, France, or America in the 60s? Or did those exact same boomers who rebelled in 1968 grow up to be the good little bourgeois that Althusser said they would be? You know what happened. You know what actually happened. And in fact, I've got books here that talk about this exact process. There's a book by Helen Andrews called Boomers that goes back to that moment in 68. And it talks about how they thought they would bring their rebellion into the workplace. That, you know, Steve Jobs and all of these sorts of characters, Jeffrey Sachs is one of them as well, and Aaron Sorkin and all of these people thought they would bring their new values, their new countercultural rebellious spirit into the workplace, into the corporate sphere. The irony should not be lost from the pure Marxist perspective. They just became the next. They just replicated the system again. And this is the genius of capitalism, because it is able to replicate itself even through the mechanisms of its own subversion. All of these boomers would have been seen as subversives at the time. but they ended up simply replicating capitalism again. Okay, that'll do for now. Pick up a course at the academic agency. I've become rather flustered and hot here. It's promo code Scorcher, and I'll see you all next time. Have a good weekend. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.